The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Now, Donald Trump came to power in America on a phrase, "Make America Great Again," which seemed to tap into a belief, not just in America, but in other countries, that things were better in the past, that technological progress isn't all that it's cracked up to be, that multiculturalism isn't a great idea. But as it happens, maybe they're spreading the fake news. Steven Pinker is with us. He has written many best-selling books. His new one is called Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism and Progress. Steven, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thanks for having me.
Would you explain to me, though, and for our listeners, what you mean by enlightenment?
It's an allusion to the period in the second half of the 18th century in which numerous philosophers in Britain, in America, in France, in Germany proposed that we emphasize reason as a way of analyzing our affairs as opposed to falling back on tradition and dogma and religion, that we look to science to help us understand the world and including ourselves, and that we come up with institutions that make humanity better off, that we set up a hope for progress in coming up with ways of improving the human condition.
But aren't many of those institutions now under threat? Aren't they crumbling from an emotional reaction to things rather than a reasoned one?
Absolutely. I think crumbling would be an exaggeration. They're certainly under threat, but it's too soon to say that they're crumbling.
Eroded? They've been eroded?
People are pushing against them. The United Nations still exists. The European Union still exists. The number of democracies is still much higher than it was just 10 years ago. So there's definitely been pushback, but it's premature to say that they're crumbling.
Okay, but why is there so much pushback?
Some of the people have been left behind. They feel they've been left behind by many of the progressive developments of recent decades. They have worked to the enormous advantage of course, ethnic minorities, of women, of gay people, worldwide of poor countries that have gotten richer. But there are some sectors of rich Western countries, predominantly male, predominantly older, predominantly rural, that feel annoyed by a number of these developments, feel sometimes threatened by the rise of immigration, threatened by terrorism, and have taken for granted the enormous benefits of the post-war order.
But hold on, do they not have reason to be concerned and upset by what they perceive to be happening?
It depends on what the solutions are. I mean, certainly people who have been economically displaced, obviously by globalization, by automation, have a right to feel discontent. But a lot of the people who voted, say, for Donald Trump in the United States are not poor people. They're not unemployed. The two lowest fifths of the income distribution voted for Hillary Clinton. What annoys a lot of these people are things like affirmative action, that is, favoring racial minorities in order to rectify past injustices.
Our current injustices?
Past and current. Current, yes, and current. That's often what gets the Trump voters most exercised.
And that is something that happens on this side of the Atlantic as well, that there would be, particularly in continental Europe, there would be many people who would agree with that. But one of the cases that you make in your new book, Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism and Progress, is that we are an awful lot better off than we used to be. Now, in what way? Because I'd imagine even a lot of people who are working, who have good jobs, feel that they can barely make ends meet, that if they are to enjoy a reasonably good standard of living, they're having to work exceptionally long, hard hours to do so.
Well, in fact, people worked longer hours in the past. Work hours have been going down. Possessions that people can afford have been going up. There are obviously problems in today's economy, but yesterday's economy wasn't so great. There were periods of massive inflation, of economic stagnation. Poverty rates were much higher in the 1960s than they are today. So it's a mistake to look at the problems that we have now as reasons to turn back to some golden age that never existed.
Yeah, but for many people, history is almost irrelevant, isn't it? It's their own personal experience is all that's really relevant to them.
Well, a lot of people actually are, that people who vote for populist candidates, they're actually, they think that everyone else is worse off. They aren't necessarily worse off themselves. They're angry about the way the country is going. There are a large number of people who say the economy is awful for everyone else. For me, it's actually been okay. And there's a big gap between people judging their own lives and then people having their theories about what's happening.
Yeah, but
hang on,
why are they angry so? Because anger is an emotion, and I've been arguing with you. You say reason is something that is there in the population at large, but doesn't that seem that emotion is overwhelming reason?
Emotion has always affected people's political opinions. And we may be seeing something of an increase in that, but there have been emotional votes in the past as well. Again, I think this isn't a book about 2018. So I'm not really trying to diagnose the latest election
results.
You're
looking at longer-term trends.
Yes, I'm looking at longer-term trends from centuries to decades. So it's not a book of political commentary. I've got to make that clear. I'm talking about things such as the fact that life expectancy has been massively increasing, such as the rate of death in warfare has been going down, such as that worldwide a majority of people are able to read and write for the first time in history, that disease is being conquered, that democracy, despite some obvious setbacks like in Russia and in Venezuela and Turkey, democracy is really riding a long-term wave, that the world has never been more democratic than it has been in this decade.
In this decade, because there were plenty of instances in the 20th century of genocide which emerged as a result. It didn't seem particularly enlightened during the Holocaust, for example.
Well, indeed, and because the Holocaust and fascism were counter-enlightenment movements, they did not prioritize the well-being of individuals. They didn't treat humans as a single species, but rather sought the glory of the nation at the expense of other nations. So yes, the two world wars were triumphs of counter-enlightenment nationalism, fascism, and romanticism.
Is it possible, though, that we could be perhaps a little bit complacent about development, saying everything is getting better, when you have, for example, technological developments, artificial intelligence, which could do away with work for so many people and not give them alternatives where they actually feel valued or actually have a value?
It is something to worry about. Despite the rise of artificial intelligence, we don't see it happening yet. It's true that some jobs will be made obsolete, but we don't know that new jobs won't arise to take their place. There are always going to be things that robots can't do, and those are the things that we ought to pay people to do. Now, the fact, for example, there are no more telephone switchboard operators, that there are no more wheelwrights, doesn't mean that unemployment has massively increased since the 1920s.
And is employment better now? Is it better for people that they're doing jobs rather than actually pulling out a plug from one telephone point and putting it into another?
Indeed, that's right.
Although there are probably plenty of jobs that are quite like that now as well.
Of course, there are. But modern economies are quite dynamic. They accommodated the massive influx into the workplace of women starting in the 1970s. And it wasn't the case that every woman who got a job displaced a one man. The economy managed to find jobs for both men and women.
You're looking at long-term trends and you go back as far as the 18th century, but the pace of change now is so dramatic, and particularly with computerization in recent decades. Any fears that the human condition, the human brain, cannot keep up with the extraordinary pace of change that computerization has brought about?
Well, it certainly brings a feeling of stress that it's hard to keep up, especially for older generations, looking at what the younger generation masters. But of course, we outsource or we subcontract a lot of the work and calculation to our machines that we used to have to keep in our own heads. We all pull out our smartphones when we have to look something up in Wikipedia or in Google. More and more, we're using data sets and graphs to show us relationships that we couldn't possibly work out number by number in our head. So we develop technologies to take the burden off our puny cognitive processes, too.
Yeah, but your academic background is as an experimental psychologist. And one of the things that people are concerned about now for smartphones, for example, is that some sort of giant global experiment has been conducted with children and teenagers that they seem to be developing, according to some people, I don't know what your opinion is on this, but an inability to actually relate properly with fellow human beings because they're constantly on their phones. What do you make of that?
Well, we haven't. The phenomenon is so new that the culture hasn't adjusted yet. In all cases, when there's a new technological development, it takes time to develop social norms and expectations and habits and polite reactions that accommodate the new technology. Just as when television was invented, there was a fear that families would never say a word to each other. They'd just be zombies staring at the screen.
And many of them were.
And then many of them were eating dinner out of frozen dinners out of aluminum foil trays. Or that the telephone would result in the constant interruption of life by the phone ringing or by teenagers who would just lie in bed and talk to other teenagers for hours and never go out and meet a real human being. And there are undoubtedly excesses in the use of smartphones and social media. And we haven't yet developed the set of norms for how much is too much, limiting screen time, turning off notifications, making it known that it's rude to look at a device instead of looking at someone in the eye. But I think it's too soon to say that we're not going to adjust. Humans are clever. Humans are inherently social. We're not going to give up face-to-face contact for smartphones. We've got to reach a new equilibrium.
Okay, does that suggest, though, you think, yes, we will adjust, but there will be casualties along the way, and that's just the way life is?
Well, there's casualties to everything always. So, yes, that's the way life is, and that anything that happens will happen unevenly, and that's always been true.
Final point I want to ask you about Steven Pinker as author of Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. And I ask this particularly in light of, again, events recently in the United States, more gun murders in schools. Are we a less violent race now than perhaps we used to be, the human race?
Yes, in terms of we behave less violently, even though we're the same species that we used to be. But yes, despite the highly publicized school shootings, rates of homicide in the United States have plummeted. They're less than half of what they were in the early 1990s. Rates of death in warfare are on a downward slope with ups and downs and blips. Violent government practices like capital punishment are in decline. Violence against women is in decline, violence against children, the spanking of children, the physical abuse of children.
So why is this? Is this because of a greater mindfulness amongst people, or is it because of less tolerance by the state of such activities?
It's both. I mean, and they can reinforce each other. As people become less tolerant of forms of violence that used to be part of everyday life, like, say, husbands beating wives, that's no longer acceptable, and states will increasingly intervene to protect women or to remove abusive men. Likewise, street violence, which people accepted certainly through the 1970s, as people got sick of the muggings and stabbings in urban areas, more police were hired. Police got clever in their tactics. They kept better data. They concentrated their efforts more on where the crime rates were highest, and they managed to bring crime rates down.
That would suggest, though, vigilance is required on a regular basis. But how much vigilance should the state put in place?
Well, clearly the power of the state has to be constrained so that we don't live in a police state or a totalitarian society. So there's an optimal amount of policing. But we've come to learn that a fair and effective policing can eliminate some of the need for itself as crime rates go down.
Okay, but fair and effective. What about fear? And this is where I perhaps will finish, because I know your book is not about politics today. But even again today, President Donald Trump has been making a speech in front of a major conservative association in the United States. And the message seems to be all about fear. And again, he's tweeting today about building the wall with Mexico to stop people coming in to ruin the American way of life. Why is fear so attractive to so many people you have a much more enlightened, better world, as you argue?
Yes. Well, the evidence for the better world depends on education, depends on sophisticated journalism. It depends on an appreciation of numbers and trends and
people
data.
Believing facts and believing experts who they tend now to denigrate.
Well, especially when you have politicians such as Donald Trump exploiting some of our more primitive impulses, such as fear, such as the negativity bias, the fact that people are far more affected by negative things than positive things. And I think encouraged inadvertently by a journalistic culture that considers good news to be kind of fluff or not worthy of reporting, but harps on everything that can go wrong. It almost feeds the narrative that we have much to fear. And I argue that inadvertently some of the gross negativity of popular and journalistic culture paved the way for Donald Trump to say the society is a disaster, only I can save it. And that if we realized how much is actually going better, we'd be less receptive to someone who would say only I can fix it.
Thank you very much for joining us. Steven Pinker, the book is called Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism and Progress.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.